Okay. Obviously, the national question, the role of Quebec and the First Nations within the Canadian state is at the center of politics in this country. It's a permanent feature. It's shaped Canadian politics in key aspects. Some of them are obvious, and some of them are not so obvious. Caledonia and the struggle of the Six Nations there is only the most recent example, with developers selling houses built on land that is not that is clearly contested as its native land. It belongs to the Six Nations. This national question is there also in very mundane things that we talk about day to day. When you talk about childcare, immediately Quebec comes to mind because of people know there is a different policy there, the $7 a day childcare program. The question of war, it raises the national question in this country. Sponsorship programs, fiscal imbalances, federal elections, etc. As socialists within Canada who want to see an end to capitalism here and around the world, obviously we're international socialists, we have a very serious task before us. We have to understand why the national question comes up over and over again, why it persists, what are the historic roots of that question, and the means by which we can overcome the divisions which emerged with the birth of the Canadian state. And so in this talk, I'm going to focus on the issue of Quebec, but the broad strokes of the method that I'm going to outline for understanding this applies equally to First Nations. It applies in general when we're talking about oppressed nations. I'm going to look in the first part specifically at providing a framework in which we can understand the national question, how Marxists approach this question in general, and then later, in the later part of the talk, I'm going to focus on how we apply that specifically to Quebec. So in the Communist Manifesto, I'm going to quote a little bit from some of the classics here, because I think, I mean, certainly for myself, in clarifying my understanding of this, it was very important to actually go and read some of these things. The Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx and Frederick Engels wrote, "The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the whole surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. The bourgeoisie compels all nations, on pain of extinction, to adopt the bourgeois mode of production, capitalism. It compels them to introduce what it calls civilization in their midst, i.e. to become bourgeois themselves. In one word, it creates a world after its own image." So that's one description in the Communist Manifesto. As capitalism develops, so does the world working class. And again, in the manifesto, they put it this way. The working men, as I talk about working men in those days, the working men have no country. National differences and antagonisms between peoples are daily more and more vanishing, owing to the development of the bourgeoisie, to freedom of commerce, to the world market, to uniformity in the mode of production, and in the conditions of life corresponding thereto. But developments in world capitalism were contradictory. National divisions didn't more and more disappear. They actually were aggravated, not lessened, with the imperialist phase of capitalist development. A handful of advanced capitalist states exercised their dominance over the rest of the world, dividing countries in a global pecking order, I guess, into oppressor and oppressed nations. So along with, economic exploitation that was universal, the working class of the oppressed nations suffered also national oppression, their countries having been subjugated or engulfed by imperialist states. And in response to conditions of national oppression, nationalist movements developed in the oppressed countries. As well within the advanced countries, reformist bureaucracies within the workers' movement. They emerged and they saw their interests as being tied to the interests of their own capitalist state. The idea of a national interest transcending class interests became a central feature of reformism. And I think if you look today, for example, at the NDP, which I'll talk a little bit about later, that sense of a national interest is very much at the heart of their project. So therefore, in both oppressed and oppressor nations, nationalism became an integral part of capitalism worldwide. So Marx had foreseen the possibility of fewer antagonisms between nations as capitalism developed, because it does provide that uniformity he talks about. But he also recognized the contradictions and the tensions in the dynamic of the capitalist system as it expanded internationally, but it relied on the national state in its competition for control of markets and resources. Marx studied the impact of the division of the world, into oppressor and oppressed nations. And one of the clearest examples that he looked at was the division between England and Ireland. In 1869, Marx wrote, "I have become more and more convinced, and the only question is to drive this conviction home to the English working class, that it, the working class in England, can never do anything decisive here in England until it separates its policy with regard to Ireland most definitely from the policy of the ruling classes, until it not only makes common cause with the Irish, but actually takes the initiative in dissolving the Union established in 1801 and replacing it by a free federal relationship. And this must be done not as a matter of sympathy with Ireland, but as a demand made in the interests of the English proletariat, that it's something that actually is necessary for the English working class to move forward." And he explained it this way, and I think, again, I'm going to quote a little bit. I hope I don't bore people to tears with this, but it is very interesting because every time I read this, I think about our situation, and it makes me think about how true this is and how important it is that people see this. He said, "Every industrial and commercial center in England now possesses a working class divided into two hostile camps, English proletarians and Irish proletarians. The ordinary English worker hates the Irish worker as a competitor who lowers his standard of life. In relation to the Irish worker, he feels himself a member of the ruling nation and so turns himself into a tool of the aristocrats and capitalists of his country against Ireland, thus strengthening their domination over himself. He cherishes religious, social, and national prejudices against the Irish worker. His attitude towards him is much the same as that of the poor whites to the niggers in the former slave states of the USA. The Irishman pays him back with interest in his own money. He sees in the English worker at once the accomplice and the stupid tool of the English rule in Ireland. And this antagonism is artificially kept alive and intensified by the press, the pulpit, the comic papers, in short, by all the means at the disposal of the ruling classes. This antagonism is the secret of the impotence of the English working class, despite its organization. It is the secret by which the capitalist class maintains its power." I think that's very interesting because, we'll talk about this in discussion, but those are the means by which the ruling class can keep control and keep people divided and fragmented, and it's been used over and over again, fostering, divide and conquer, that strategy. We see it all around the world today. Because this division within the working class weakens its ability to wage a struggle against the capitalist class, which is its enemy. Socialists within the oppressor country have to fight against chauvinism towards the oppressed nation. They have to defend the right of oppressed nations to self-determination, the right for those oppressed nations to secede, to decide to leave if they want to do so. And in some circumstances, socialists in the oppressor nation actually have to advocate the oppressed nation's secession if the conditions are so impossible to function and are holding back the ability of workers to fight in a united way against their common enemies. In Ireland's case, Marx believed that the depth of the antagonisms between England and Ireland meant that it would be necessary for Ireland to secede before there could be any genuine unity between the workers of the two countries, and therefore and before there could be a socialist revolution in England. He said, "The sole means of hastening the revolution is to make Ireland independent. Hence, it is the task of the International," which was the Workers' International, everywhere, "to put the conflict between England and Ireland in the foreground and everywhere to side openly with Ireland." So that was Marx's, in a nutshell. I mean, he wrote so much on this question, Ireland and the Irish question, I think it's called. I think we might even have it here in the book room. His position was later developed by another revolutionary, Vladimir Lenin, who was a leader of the Bolshevik Party. The Tsarist Empire, the Russian Empire, was known as the Prison House of Nations, with the minority Great Russians. I'm not quite sure why they're called the Great Russians, but they're Great Russians, dominated a country made up of a majority non-Russians. 57% were non-Russians. And in looking at the attitude that socialists should have towards the oppressed nationalities within Russia, Lenin, he started off with Marx's work and in another very good book called The Right of Nations to Self-Determination, which, if you want a sort of a good starting point and all the debates that were taking place in the revolutionary left at that time, which are very, very important debates to know about, this is a very good, and again, I'm just going to quote a little bit at length to talk about how he developed a broader defense of the right of self-determination of all oppressed nations. He said, let us consider the position of an oppressor nation. Can a nation be free if it oppresses other nations? It cannot. The interests of the freedom of the great Russian population require a struggle against such oppression. The long centuries-old history of the suppression of the movements of oppressed nations and the systematic propaganda in favor of such suppression coming from the upper classes have created enormous obstacles to the cause of freedom for the great Russian people itself in the form of prejudices and so on. The great Russian proletariat cannot, that's the proletariat working class, if you know, that's the language of the time, cannot achieve its own aims or clear the road to its freedom without systematically countering these prejudices. But he also said, it's the duty of socialists in the oppressed nation to fight for and maintain complete absolute unity, organizational unity, between the workers of the oppressed nation and the workers of the oppressing nation. Without such unity, it will be impossible to maintain an independent working class policy and class solidarity with the workers of other countries in the face of all of the, what he called, subterfuge, treachery, and trickery of the bourgeoisie. For the bourgeoisie of the oppressed nations, you know, in this case, so you're talking about Canada and Quebec, say Quebec, the bourgeoisie of the oppressed nations always converts the slogan of national liberation into a means of deceiving the workers. And I'll get back to that one in a second as well. So while acknowledging the dangers posed by bourgeois nationalism in the oppressed nation, and the fact that national self-determination alone is not going to solve all the contradictions and problems created by the capitalist system, Lenin said that we fight against the privileges and violence of the oppressor nation and do not in any way condone strivings for privileges on the part of the oppressed nation. Think about First Nations, for example. The oppressor nation, we have to fight against the privileges and violence of the oppressor nation, and we also have to talk about in the oppressed nation fighting for an attempt to seek privileges there. The bourgeois nationalism of any oppressed nation has a general democratic content that is directed against oppression, and it is this content which we unconditionally support. At the same time, we strictly distinguish it from the tendency towards national exclusiveness. In the case of Russia, they were talking about Poland, the fact that in Poland, the Polish bourgeois would oppress the Jewish minority in Poland and so on. So all this is a kind of a complex picture that I can think of. So unconditional but critical support. And the reason for that is because Marxism sees social class and not nationality as the main divide in society. We're critical of the strategy and politics adopted by nationalist movements of oppressed nations. And so while we draw a distinction between the nationalism of oppressor nations, you know, and oppressed nations, and we support the oppressed nations in their anti-imperialist demands, Marxism doesn't make any concessions to nationalism as an ideology. We don't ever make concessions there. So summarizing Lenin, to achieve the highest basis of unity of the working class, workers in the dominant or imperialist nation have to be broken from their own nationalism and identification with their own national state. And understanding that the workers in the oppressed nation will never break from their nationalism and their ruling class unless they are recognized as equals by the workers in the oppressor nation. But workers in the oppressed nation will never be free if they seek privileges vis-a-vis other oppressed groups or if they simply follow their own national bourgeoisie. So that's the outline. And one last thing on this question, just in terms of a framework to look at it. How am I doing?
You did great. So that.
Okay. Thank you. In looking at how we decide, you know, what is and what isn't an oppressed nation? You know, how do we know this? How do we measure it? Is it an economic question? Is it, you know, if you look at the Ireland I talked about earlier, the potato famine, if you look at what actually happened and the horrific impact of British imperialism on there, you know, it's a very clear, look at First Nations here. Look at the situation of First Nations people. Leon Trotsky wrote about this. He's another Russian revolutionary, and he wrote about, in this case, about black nationalism in America, and he said that objective indices, you know, like unemployment and child mortality rates and access to education and so on, those are not sufficient to really determine if a nation's oppressed or not. He said, what is much more decisive is the historical consciousness, the feelings and the impulses of people, you know, the way that they feel as a group and the history of that. So it's very concrete. You have to look at a whole number of factors, and you have to look at including the historical consciousness in the case in point. So how do we apply this to Canada? I'm going to argue, obviously, First Nations and Quebec constitute oppressed nations within Canada. Canada is a multinational state. Say it's a prison house of nations. I mean, some will see it more that way than others. I think that the example of Caledonia, I don't know if people saw some of the conflicts between some of the residents, some very racist outbursts from residents there towards the First Nations people, and they were saying, if you don't, you say you're not Canadian, get out of here. It's like they're the original peoples of this country, and it's just so horrifying to look at that. But First Nations obviously are oppressed, but Quebec, I'm going to talk about primarily the history of Quebec's oppression in this country. Valerie Lannan did an excellent presentation yesterday on First Nations, so anyone interested in looking at that more can get the CD on that. Quebec was conquered militarily in 1759, was incorporated into a confederation that Quebecers believe has worked against their interests. The Quebecois feel themselves to be dominated and oppressed by the Canadian state, which attempts to control and regulate language, culture, society. And so the response to the smallest incident today, something like the sponsorship scandal, is nourished by a real well of history, of that historical consciousness that Trotsky talks about, that bubbles up when a small thing can come up. There are all these currents it can run along and come up to the surface very quickly. First of all, the brutality of the conquest itself. And of course, there's the whole question that the French came here and there were the wars with the Iroquois and so on. And I'm not going to have time to really adequately address that. But this is the fact. There was, in New France and so on, was conquered by Britain. The shrinking of the territory that was New France, that went from Labrador right down to the Mississippi, to basically a territory along the St. Lawrence. The British cultivated and propped up the French elite. They chose to maintain the dominance of the feudal aristocracy and the Catholic Church for their own imperialist interests. I'm going to breeze through a bit of this history, but I think you can see, my main point here is not to give a history lesson, but to show what are those currents along which national sentiment runs in Quebec. And it's the experience of this, the way the British shaped the regime after conquest in New France in 1774, the Quebec Act, which codified the terms of conquest. It gave minimal concessions to the feudal hierarchy and to the Catholic Church. Stanley Ryerson, who has written a lot about the origins of Canada, and he's a Marxist. He wrote this Quebec Act was a maneuver to head off a convergence with the rebellious colonies to the south, because there was a lot going on in what's now the U.S. at that time. The Constitutional Act of 1791, which replaced the province of Quebec with two separate ones, Upper and Lower Canada, which basically corresponds to the southern parts of Ontario and Quebec today. Each one of those getting an elected assembly. It was a legislative sleight of hand that freed loyalist settlers from the feudal land tenure system that was in the province of Quebec, and gave greater British control. When rebellions broke out in 1837, the Patriot leaders, there's a rebellion in Upper Canada, there was one in Lower Canada. In Lower Canada, the Patriot leaders were executed and their supporters were deported. There's a very interesting film, probably most people haven't even heard of it, but in Quebec it was a big, big deal. It was the 15th February 1839. It was a big hit. All my family went and ran out to go see it. It's always kind of interesting because they never come here unless you go to a rep or something. And it basically describes, Chevalier de Lorimier being jailed in the repression of the rebellion and the execution of these guys. The enactment of Confederation under the British North America Act in 1867, that's identified as the birth of Canada. It set out the key constitutional arrangements that applied until 1982, and we know what happened in 1982. It was not a very, again, it was sort of feeding what was clearly a pattern here of national oppression. It nailed down, the Confederation nailed down the hegemony of the Anglophone bourgeoisie, And although, of course, that bourgeoisie had the collaboration of a minority section of the French elite, the view of Canada from the fathers of Confederation was very clear. It was basically the view of an imperial, you know, central government towards colonies. It was based on that pattern. And so, you know, over time you see a situation where French Canadians, who had made up three quarters of the population of Lower Canada, by 1871 they make up a third of Canada as a whole. And so that was the enshrining of, you know, of French Canadians as a minority within this. So that's the historical development of this. And a few other examples just to point to that, to point to that show why national feeling runs very deep inside Quebec. During World War I, there was the conscription crisis. There were a number of conscription crises in World War II as well, but during World War I, there were huge clashes in Quebec when thousands of Quebecers refused to fight in defense of the Canadian state. It happened again during World War II. In October 1970, the imposition of the World War Measures Act by Pierre Trudeau in response to the, you know, the so-called October crisis, where basically Quebec was occupied by the military for a period of time. And again, there's another very good film there called Les Ordres, The Orders. If you haven't seen it, it's sort of, these things are important just to get a feel for why, you know, because you're not going to have easy access to that if you're an English Canadian, unless you're a revolutionary socialist and you go out and seek it. So all of these events have nourished that sentiment in Quebec. But there have been different strands of nationalism. The first strand, you know, in the early part of the 19th century, the Patriotes, led by Louis-Joseph Papineau, it was the nationalism of the French-Canadian petty bourgeoisie directed against the neo-feudal seigneurs in Quebec, against the Catholic Church, and as well against the British colonialists. That nationalism saw independence and capitalist development. And it's really the same, if you look at the PQ today, the Bloc, that's the what informs that nationalism. It's a bourgeois nationalism. The defeat of the Lower Canada Rebellion in 1838, at that time you saw the consolidation of another kind of nationalism, which was a reactionary, clerical, parochial nationalism. And a lot of people think, they still think of Quebec in those terms, the Great Darkness, you know, a conservative nationalism centered on the church, and later on in an alliance of the church with the Union Nationale government of Maurice Duplessis, eventually of Maurice Duplessis. It was backward-looking. It was generally opposed to industrialization, to urbanization, and it served to stall the development of a modern capitalist infrastructure in terms of education, in terms of health, in terms of a whole range of things. And there's a third type of nationalism which emerged in Quebec more recently, a critical nationalism which sees national liberation as linked to the question of social transformation. That nationalism, that's, you know, through the workers' movement, the intelligentsia, and so on, has different understandings of what that social transformation is. But broadly speaking, you could call it anti-capitalist. It's a sort of anti-capitalist nationalism, I guess. I hope I don't run out of time, but I'm going to just say what happened between, you know, sort of that's a rough sketch from the period after World War II. Say in the 50s, Quebec experienced a rapid growth of industry, resource-based industry, and manufacturing. There were new needs in society. There was a clash developing between the Union Nationale, that type of nationalism, and the needs of the economy. They needed a more modern education system, more developed systems of communication, better health care, electricity. You can name so many things. And so this clash came about in 1960, during the election in 1960. The Union Nationale, which had been in power since 1936, was defeated by the Liberal Party under Jean Lesage. And this was the beginning of the Quiet Revolution, which was a program, really, of social, political, and economic reforms. And at the heart of that was state-directed development of Quebec. It was a maneuver by the Quebec petty bourgeoisie to get a hold of the state apparatus and use it to strengthen its economic and political position. And it's also from that petty bourgeoisie that this new dynamic separatist ideology came about. There was a split in the project of national modernization of Quebec. On the one side, you had, you know, allied with the Liberal Party, a faction that, while it encouraged modernization of Quebec, it thought it could be done within the framework of the federal Canadian state. Another section started advocating political secession, political separation from Canada. In 1967, René Lévesque left the Liberal Party and he founded something called Mouvement Souveraineté Association. And a year later, the PQ was formed. But that, in the same context, you had also the growth of left ideas in Quebec in a massive way. The unionization rate rose dramatically. Through this modernization, you had a huge growth of public sector. I mean, it's phenomenal in 10 years, the changes that happened, and a quiet revolution, because it wasn't, you know, just about being in the streets. It's just like the whole infrastructure was transformed, and the loosening of the grip of clerical ideas and just modernization. The international wave of resistance to imperialism and oppression that we saw, you know, from the struggle around Vietnam, the Vietnam War, the Black Power movement, the Women's Liberation movement, all of these things feeding into what was going on inside Quebec, the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia, the struggles in the former colonies in Africa and Asia and Latin America, all of that fed into the growth of left ideas. And in this context, the fight against national oppression, you know, against this experience of being subjugated and so on, often served as a catalyst for militant workers' actions, actually, militant strikes. French-speaking workers were pitted against Anglo-Canadian and American employers. And just a little statistic at the time, around that time, the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism came out, and French speakers in Quebec ranked, you know, in the ranked income, they ranked 12th in income, just above Italian Canadians and First Nations people. First Nations are 14th. So you can see this very, you know, in terms of the reality, that report revealed that by all criteria, it was in Quebec that French Canadians were consistently most disadvantaged and that the minority English Canadians were most advantaged. The minority English Canadians had the highest standards of living in Quebec. So, you know, this is a very intense kind of reality. And so a lot of workers' struggles, you know, fueled by the sense of we need to challenge this, exploded. And actually, you see a process where, you know, of course, there was the occupation in 1970, the War Measures Act. By 1972, this very radicalized environment and the growth of new unions and the whole, you know, the whole political ferment that was going on. 1972, over 200,000 Quebec workers walked off the job. It was the largest general strike in North American history to that date. I think it might have been surpassed a few times, including, was it last Monday, the immigrants, day without immigrants in the U.S., where a million people didn't go to work or whatever. But it was part of a wave of working class struggle. I mean, the features of that strike deserve their own talk, but the occupation of radio stations and all kinds of stuff that happened, it was really, really tremendous. It was part of a wave of working class struggle in 1976. It spilled over in October 1976. A 250,000 Quebec workers took part in a one-day general strike against wage controls, but that was alongside a million workers in English Canada. So this was a process. It's what I'm describing about Quebec is actually, in terms of the radicalization, in terms of the militancy, in terms of these things, was going on across Canada. As left-wing nationalism grew in Quebec, there was a parallel development within English Canada. And thank you. I'm gonna conclude on this question, because this is gonna bring us to the nub of the problems that we face. If people agree that there is a national question in Canada and that it poses problems, we have to identify how the fault lines play through in our, we're in the oppressor nation here, we're in English Canada. So in English Canada, what's going on at this time? There is the development of left nationalism in Canada. It identified Canada as a colony of the United States. One articulation of this view you can find in a book by Carrie Leavitt called Silent Surrender, The Multinational Corporation in Canada. You know, I think the arguments that she developed still greatly influenced, actually, the outlook of the English-Canadian left. Like, there have been changes in that, but by and large, what is it? Canada is a branch plant economy of the U.S. The task of the left is to mobilize around a new nationalism to strengthen the central Canadian state to counteract the pressures exerted by the U.S., the big, you know, the big elephant to the south, or I think it was Trudeau, whatever he said. And so within that outlook, you get, in left nationalism, at best, you know, the, in my opinion, the reason for recognizing Quebec rights, you know, maybe asymmetrical federalism, maybe this, maybe that accommodation, is to maintain Canada as an entity which cannot be easily chipped away at by American imperialism. And that's more or less what's been played out over, I don't know, a long, long time in the left in English Canada. There were sections in English Canada of the left, the far left, in that period, you know, during the Vietnam War, during the 1970s, there was a fairly sizable section of the far left that recognized the Quebec's right to self-determination, including secession, including the right to independence. That's their decision. That has whittled down to, you know, a very small nub, I say, and I would say. And most of the English Canadian left today, certainly, but I would say even then, provided conditional support to Quebec's right to self-determination. I talk at the beginning about unconditional but critical support for Quebec and its struggle against national oppression. The English-Canadian left provided conditional support based on a presumption of shared anti-Americanism. But as Carrie Leavitt herself wrote, she said, it's interesting that public opinion polls, and this is 1972, public opinion polls constantly show less concern about American domination in Quebec than anywhere else in Canada. What difference, after all, to the French-Canadian worker in Alvida whether orders are received in English from a foreman employed by a Canadian company like Alcan or an American company like Union Carbide? And so missing that point, if you miss that point, it doesn't. There's more to it than this idea that it's all America. The absence of clarity, pardon the pun, on where Canada fits in the imperialist pecking order of nations has meant that this left nationalism in English Canada has put the left in a collision with those who are and should be seen as the natural allies of, in our struggle to transform society, the workers, the working class of Quebec. And this was expressed, you know, very sharply around the Meech Lake debate. I would love to have time to do my section on Meech Lake, but I won't have time. But I will just say a couple of things about it. When you read, if you read, I'll point out another book that might interest people, a pamphlet that we put out on Quebec. In here that describes in great detail what happened around Meech Lake and the debates, and much more than that, the whole history of it. When you read over what was happening around Meech Lake, which was an attempt, basically, to recognize Quebec as a distinct society and to find a measure of dealing with all this previous history I've talked about of not recognizing Quebec. When you read it, though, what's frightening is it's like a deja vu. At the time, it was a free trade FTA. What was that? Free trade agreement. The FTA. This was 1988. The Tories were gaining. They won the election. Before they won the 1988. Before they won the election, there was a whole debate in the left about tactical voting. I just found all this stuff from Canadian Dimension. People know it's a left magazine in this country. All these articles calling for tactical voting and that we had to ally the NDP and the Liberals to stop the Tories because the FTA and the Tories would destroy Canada. And sure enough, what happened? Quebec voted heavily Tory for a whole variety of reasons I don't have time to go into. Quebec nationalists, that meant a huge bashing of Quebec for a variety of reasons. There was a right-wing bashing of Quebec that was like the, you know, sort of the there's a group called the Alliance for the Preservation of English in Canada. If you didn't realize, English is in danger of disappearing in Canada. But anyways, they were the sort of the people who would be, you know, they would be like the people at the barricades in Caledonia, the very right, far right wing anti-Quebec people. But also the left bashed Quebec because of this. A lot of, you know, to hell with Quebec. They won't go along with the whole slogan, no A, that the that was put forward at that time. Of course, as a result of that Quebec bashing from the right and from the left, the Quebec Nationalists gained, which meant, you know, the working class in Quebec was locked into following their own national bourgeoisie. So I don't have time to really talk about all of the Michelet. I'm sorry I didn't really make enough time. I have to wrap up, right? But I will just say that from Meech Lake, Charlottetown, all the way through to today, because we're going to be back into it very soon with an election next year, when it's quite clear that the PQ will win. It's quite clear. I'm quite sure that they will win, that there will be a new referendum. The importance of getting the national question right is very, very crucial. There's huge potential for the movements that have developed over the past decade, I would say, to make huge breakthroughs. If you look at the anti-war movement, if you look at what happened in Quebec City around the Free Trade Area of the Americas, if you look at the student strike in Quebec recently that won, 250,000 students went on strike and they won, all the way through, you know, there's so much potential for us to take the very key struggles forward in a united way, unless we understand it, you know, this sort of mechanism, this framework that I talked about earlier. How do we look at Quebec in the pecking order of nations, and where do we situate ourselves in the left in English Canada? Unless we get that right, it could really have terrible consequences. It has in the past. It's been overcome partially around Quebec City. You think about the joint mobilization, but it's always there in the cracks. We have to find ways over and over again to take up this issue in our unions, in the New Democratic Party, the NDP. The majority, as far as I know, NDP members did not support the Clarity Act, but the leadership has, Jack Layton has said, they support the Clarity Act. This is a disaster. It is a disaster. And I was just at a talk, I'll just conclude on this. Deborah Burke, the president of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, just did a very interesting presentation on the Clarity Act. Their union has fought very, very hard to educate their members about the national question, about Quebec. They have a very good position. They are for Quebec's right to self-determination up to and including. If they decide to leave, they can leave. It's their right to decide. This is incredibly important. And she used the example. She said, the Clarity Act, we explained it to our members like this. The Clarity Act, for people who don't know, it's, you know, the Canadian government has now put in a law that says that Quebec doesn't have the right to decide the question that they're going to ask in a future referendum. It's the Canadian government ultimately decides. 50% plus one is not a majority, et cetera, et cetera. The Canadian government will set the terms for a referendum that happens in Quebec about its own future. This is a problem. And the way that they explained it to their members and had a discussion about it is if your members in a union vote on a collective agreement, and it's very close majority. And the boss comes and says, well, we didn't like the way you framed the question, and we don't recognize the results, we don't think it's a significant majority. What would workers do with that? They'd probably walk out. They would probably go on strike. And if you think about, in terms of the relations between inequality between Canada and Quebec, that's what we're talking about. You cannot force people. And so I'll just conclude on this. The idea that we can and must challenge chauvinism in English Canada towards Quebec is vital. It's vital around the question of First Nations, because we need unity, whether or not Quebec separates or not in the future. We need unity as a working class in North America to challenge our state and to challenge our ruling class. And how does this benefit the English Canadian working class to be the dupes and basically the stupid tools of our bourgeoisie? That's how Marx put it in the 1860s and 50s, and I think it's still applicable today. We have to look at how our ruling class uses this question over and over again to divide us, and do everything we can to counter that division. And I'll wrap up there, and we can discuss it some more.